Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Wolves are our topic today on Access Utah. And my guest for the hour is uniquely positioned, uncomfortably in the middle of this freighted topic. Here's a quote from the blurb from his memoir, which is called Wolfer. His plan was to stay in Iowa, maybe to get a job counting ducks or do a little farming, but events conspired to fling Carter Niemeyer westward and straight into the jaws of wolves. From his early years wrangling ordinary federal trappers, eagles, and grizzlies to winning a skinning contest that paved the way for a wolf reintroduction to the northern Rockies, Carter Niemeyer reveals the wild and bumpy ride that turned a trapper, a killer, into a champion of wolves.
The following originally aired earlier this year and is an encore presentation.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com, providing tools to manage the online reputations of businesses in search results and reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
With your Utah News, I'm Carrie Bringhurst. Utah County is where Vice Presidential candidate Paul Ryan spent his afternoon yesterday. The Wisconsin congressman was in Utah to fundraise for the GOP ticket, and although his time in the Beehive State was short, for UPR, KCPW's Jessica Gale tells us he still had time to squeeze in some time for a chat with local Boy Scouts.
After his campaign plane landed, it was a group of Provo Boy Scouts who first welcomed Vice Presidential hopeful Paul Ryan as he made his first trip to Utah since joining Mitt Romney's ticket.
He was really friendly. I felt just like he was a friend. It was great.
Seventh grader David Nelson was one of nearly a dozen scouts from Troop 720 who greeted Ryan in uniform as he stepped off the plane.
He just said, "Hi, I'm Paul Ryan. How are you doing? What's your name?"
Those few words were more than reporters and a few outside supporters of the campaign got, as Ryan quickly waved before leaving in a black SUV for multiple fundraising events at Utah Valley University. Now Scoutmaster Paul Mix, who has been a scout himself for 43 years, says it will be hard to find another event that will top one like this.
This is kind of a dream come true. I mean, other than maybe Mitt, right? But the vice president, that's awesome.
Ryan flew out of Provo last night on his way to a rally in Colorado Springs. From KCPW News in Salt Lake City, I'm Jessica Gale for Utah Public Radio.
A federal crackdown on marijuana growing in seven western states has uprooted more than 1 million plants. That's according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sacramento. Many of those plants found here in the state of Utah. That's Utah News. I'm Carrie Bringhurst.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The wolf, as we know, holds a special place in our imagination. We tend to project many of our own values, fears on the wolf. The wolf holds a special place of controversy in our policy as well, especially with the reintroduction of the wolf after its general extinction from the western United States. The controversy goes on, of course. Arguments between conservationists and ranchers, hunters enter the argument as well. My guest for the hour, Carter Niemeyer, is uniquely placed sort of in the uncomfortable middle of this controversy. He's been on either side, started out as a trapper, working for the federal government, killing wolves, and ended up as an advocate for them, and in fact placed in a position to explain the government's policies to ranchers and the public. Carter Niemeyer has written a memoir. It's called Wolfer. And his original plan was to stay in Iowa. He, after graduate school, headed westward, ended up working for an then obscure agency for the federal government, Animal Damage Control, and ended up later on being in charge of Idaho's reintroduction of the wolves in the 1990s. And Carter Niemeyer, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's start with your growing up. You grew up in Iowa on a ranch. How did you grow up?
Well, we had a small farm on the edge of town, and so my poor man's television was running around the fields, and being a young man with a BB gun and some gopher traps and enjoying the outdoors.
So you would have had typical growing up years, typical attitudes as well toward wildlife of a farmer.
Yeah. At that time, we had a lot of diversity, and farming wasn't as clean then, so we had lots of wildlife of all types. And so there was a lot of adventure for a young man to go out and roam the countryside, and we had pheasants and rabbits and Norway rats, mm-hmm. you name it.
You ended up working with predators. What do you have predators out there in Iowa?
We did. Most common predator where I grew up was red fox, and that was one of my obsessions as a young man, mm-hmm. to be able to catch a fox, and eventually I learned how, and then that was kind of the first step in wanting to take the next step and catch a coyote, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So, you just kind of work your way up from pocket gophers to skunks to foxes. And
mm-hmm. Were there coyotes out there?
We had to go to the southern part of the state, when I had my driver's license, we did go to the southern part of Iowa to go coyote hunting.
Mm-hmm. Did these experiences prepare you in any way for when you start working with larger predators?
Yeah, I think my rural background helped. You know, I grew up working on farms, baled hay, pitched manure, and did all the layman's jobs back there. And at the same time, when you learn to be a hunter and a trapper, you hone your skills so that when I did come out west to work with other predators and different types of predators, all those skills come into use.
What was your dream at that point?
Well, I think you start out, I wanted to be a wildlife biologist. So when you are a biologist, you want to, the phrase always, you know, I want to do predators, I want to do waterfowl. That's kind of an expression. I want to be a manager and hands-on and that sort of thing. That's what every biologist hopes to do. But eventually, I think the jobs often evolve into conflict resolution issues more than hands-on wildlife.
Hmm. And we'll get into this. And you've been quoted in something I was reading as saying you eventually in your career moved from being a biologist to a sociologist. So it's just that controversial.
Yeah, that's kind of the phrase that refers to when you become a sociologist, you just get into mostly human issues rather than mm-hmm. wildlife issues.
So you went to Iowa State, got your master's, I believe, decided to, you know, you were heading into your field, and what brought you west?
Well, I got out of graduate school in 1973, and it was at that time that the state of Montana needed a state trapper to work on issues with rabid skunks up in the northeast part of Montana. And I did my master's program on rabies serological study. So it kind of fit, and they offered me the job in Montana. So I hopped a train and was out there in a couple, 3 days and living in a whole different environment.
Hmm. That's something I haven't really, job description, dealing with rabid skunks. But I guess you jumped into it.
Well, yeah, I was a skunk trapper when I was a kid. And then, of course, I went to Iowa State and worked on this serological study looking at the incidence of rabies in striped skunks. So, again, it was my other skills I got as a young man that came in handy then to go out west and apply my interest and my education both.
Mm. This must have been a joy then. You're in your chosen field. You're living outdoors. You're doing what you wanted to do.
Yeah, they gave me a county Jeep up in Plentywood, Montana, and sent me out in the countryside. And our job was to eliminate as many skunks as we could in the shortest period of time to delay or slow down the spread of rabies in that population that summer.
Mm. So at this point, maybe we could backtrack a bit and talk about the wolf. At this point, as of about, what, the 1930s, wolves have been eradicated from the western U.S.
Yeah, wolves pretty much ranged over the North American continent, clear down to Mexico City. And as European settlers came across the country, and wolves were one of the animals that competed for wild game and eventually killing livestock, They were in the way, you might say, and so wolves were one of the predators that was nearly totally extirpated from the lower 48 states, with the exception of a residual population up in northern Minnesota.
Mm. Why the wolf and not some other predators? Why this extirpation from the U.S. Of the wolf?
Partly because the wolf is a social animal, and they live in packs, and they have specific territories. And the effective removal of wolves was probably accomplished through poison that was spread throughout the nation at one time. The bears and the lions fared a little better, and they held on. But I think the poisons were delivered in such a way it was to eliminate predators like the coyote and the wolf.
Mm-hmm. So we were successful in eliminating the wolf from the U.S., and I don't know when the push came to reintroduce the wolf. Of course, it actually happened in the 90s, but I'm sure there were advocates for it well before then.
There was the wolf was put on the endangered species list in 1973, and so there was talk, you know, from the 1970s forward about having a wolf plan to reestablish wolves in part of their former range. So that was a progression of plans and documents that culminated in an environmental impact statement written in 1993 and published in 1994 to actually reintroduce the wolf into parts of the West.
Hmm. Now, how did you come to work for at least then obscure federal agency called, I think at that time, Animal Damage Control?
The job in Montana, where I was a state trapper, sort of put me in a position to be available for a federal job when it opened. And Animal Damage Control was under U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the time. So when I became sort of a free agent and that temporary job ended, the federal government gave me a federal trapper position with Animal Damage Control.
Mm. And what was your job at that point?
The first job with Animal Damage Control was actually down in Dillon, Montana, to trap and relocate golden eagles that were killing sheep at the time. And so my first job that spring, March of 1975, was to capture golden eagles alive with weak foothold traps. And we put bands on them and we relocated them to different parts of the West. And that first year, I trapped 150 golden eagles and moved them.
Eagles will kill sheep?
They were deadly on lambs, and they were killing them when they were fairly newborn. There was also a lot of winter kill of the domestic sheep due to the real severe spring storms we had at that time, which kind of focused migrating golden eagles into the area.
Mm. I'll forgive a city boy's imagination. Did eagles swoop from the sky and carry off a lamb? Is that what happens?
They can. More commonly at that time, they were just landing, walking up, and impaling the lambs as they laid there on the ground. They were cold and couldn't really move. So they would just puncture them in the head or the vitals with their long talons, but they could take off with newborn lambs and actually take them up to their nest.
Mm-hmm. Now, ranchers, that's got to be very frustrating. You're out there, you're trying to make a living, and you've got all these predators out there, whether or not they're controversial as the wolf, taking your sheep.
Well, it was a big issue that particular year I went to work. It was documented through the University of Montana that the sheep grower was losing about $38,000 worth of lambs to these migrating golden eagles. So it was a serious economic issue there.
So most of the work you did, was it to protect livestock?
My role with Animal Damage Control, I was also a supervisor, but I was in charge of about 12 men, and then my job was to back them up and be a team leader and a partner. So our job was to alleviate predator problems with livestock.
Mm-hmm. What other predators did you hunt?
Mostly coyote was our focus, but I was involved a lot in dealing with grizzly bear damage. I was the technical guy with the dart gun and the drug training to immobilize the grizzlies that we caught in foot snares. And we also foot-snared black bears getting into livestock, including beehives. And to some extent, an occasional mountain lion would get into livestock, too. Mm.
Mostly, it seems like what you're telling me with a lot of this stuff is relocation.
In the first years of my job, there was a lot of effort in relocating problem animals, especially grizzly bear. They were listed as a threatened species at the time, so you just couldn't kill a grizzly bear. Mm. To a lesser extent, we moved black bears for a while, but found that they had the ability to come back and start the damage all over again. So it was the state's decision to just not relocate black bears and mountain lions.
Mm. If you just joined us, our subject is wolf, and we're getting into that. We're laying some groundwork here. Very interesting background that Carter Niemeyer, my guest, has. He started out in this then-obscure agency, Animal Damage Control, for the federal government, controlling predators. He ended up working with the reintroduction of the wolf in the 1990s and went from killing wolves to advocating for them. And that put him in a kind of an uncomfortable middle position. He's told about all of this in his memoir, Wolfer. So in this period, in the 70s, were you encountering wolves?
In my role as a federal trapper, I didn't really run into wolves until 1987, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about wolves, but they were all north of the Canadian border. And there were occasional sightings reported, but it was very difficult to document whether those sightings were real or whether they were coyotes or hybrid dogs or something.
Mm-hmm. And we just that problem persists today. There was a report in Utah recently of people reported a sighting of a wolf, but you have to verify it. Is it a hybrid? Is it a real wolf? And that goes to, you know, where wolves are spreading to.
Well, that's part of my learning experience. Once the name or the word wolf is discussed in the media, there becomes an instant awareness that I think I seen a wolf. And it becomes kind of a snowball effect where people think they see things, and it's really important that you document and make sure that you're looking for the right animal.
Mm-hmm. Now, some have described this period in 1987 as a period of wolf hysteria. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, there was a period of hysteria that I encountered, and again, it was in the very early years when there were very few actual wolves around. But when people became hypersensitive, the wolves were in the area perhaps, they would see a footprint that they didn't pay any attention to before that suddenly, I think that's a wolf track. Or an animal fleeted across the road in the night in their headlights, and that animal looked bigger than normal. And so this is kind of where the hysteria started. And then, of course, where people had dead livestock laying around the field in the past, suddenly, gosh, I wonder if a wolf killed my calf, killed my cow, killed my horse. And so that's really where my role started to grow rapidly, is being the person who had to go out and examine the tracks, examine the dead livestock, and see, you know, is there any basis to these reports?
Mm. This is a question I'm sure you get a lot. Very interesting question. What is it about the wolf? We don't seem to make these same projections of our fears and values onto the mountain lion or the bear.
Well, I find it difficult to explain sometimes, since I know the wolf well, and a lot of what I've learned about the wolf doesn't match with the stories. But I think a lot of the stories about the wolf came over from Europe and the old country and with the European settlers. And there was just an awful lot of things that wolves were accused of. And a lot of that, I think, was not necessarily based on, you know, good scientific examinations. You keep hearing about, well, all the people that wolves ate, you know, in these European countries. But if you start reading some of the books about this, those countries experienced famine. They experienced disease outbreaks. They've experienced endless wars. And there was a lot of human corpses out on the landscape that wolves ate. And so some of this spills over, and did the wolves actually kill people, or did the wolves feed upon the bodies that were laying on these battlefields?
In any case, when settlers would have come over, they would have had all of this background about the wolf.
Yeah, it had a lot of baggage, I guess. Most of what people thought about wolves apparently wasn't very complimentary of them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as settlers come over here, wolves do kill livestock if they encounter them sometimes. And so they became a competitor and one more evil influence on people.
Mm. Are people in danger in certain situations with regard to the wolf?
My experience with wolves is I've worked around them for nearly 30 years, and I've never had a close call with a wolf. Mm-hmm. And I've purposely stalked them, purposely tried to get as close to them as I could, even with a dart gun, trying to put a dart in them so that I could immobilize them. I found wolves have always run away from me and never threatened me whatsoever.
Mm. Part of the fear might come from the fact that wolves hunt in packs. You're not just potentially dealing with one wolf, you're dealing with the whole pack.
Yeah, and where I go out and enjoy the howling of a wolf pack, I think it's music to my ears, and I've camped in my tent as close to wolf packs as I can get. The howling obviously instills a deep fear into other people who are terrified by hearing the howling and have packed up their camp and gone home.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, I guess you maybe not try this at home. You wouldn't suggest people get as close to the pack as you can, or am I okay to do that?
Well, I think it's okay to do. Certainly wolves can hurt people. But the history of wolves in lower 48 states right now is that since the reintroduction of wolves, we haven't had anybody attacked or hurt below the Canadian borderline. There's been two people killed in about the last 100 years, and both of those deaths occurred, one in Alaska, one in Canada, in the last 3-4 years. Again, people need to remember there are 60,000 to 65,000 wolves that live in Canada and Alaska, and those deaths occurred where that population has been virtually forever.
Hmm. So I guess have some protection with you, have your gun or whatever.
Yeah, in all the years I've worked with wolves, I've never carried a gun.
Yeah.
It's not been in my thought process to carry a gun because I've just not felt threatened by wolves whatsoever.
Did you have a backup plan without a gun?
No.
Should something happen? I guess you just figured nothing would happen.
I've never thought about wolves as harming me, and I was careful. I've never been bitten by one. You just be careful and respect the animal for what they mm-hmm. can do to you.
Now, from what you know of the wolf, and you've spent a lot of time around wolves, studied them, what's your sense of the animal? What have you come to take away from your attitude toward wolves?
Wolves, to me, are just another critter out in the woods. They're just like the fox, the coyote, the grizzly bear. They're like the deer and the elk. They're wildlife. They're a native animal of this country. They were here long before us. And the problem I think we have now is that they were gone before the reintroduction. We'd eliminated them by the 1930s. So people are finding it very difficult to receive or accept wolves back into their environment. It's an inconvenience.
Hmm. Let's talk a bit about some of the, and I'm sure you've heard many of these objections. In fact, you're assigned to be the point man in some cases, talking with ranchers, with the public. Starting with ranchers, what are these statistics? I'm sure just at the base of it, ranchers have all these predators out there, damaging their livestock, and now we reintroduce one more.
Well, certainly wolves have been accused of being the straw that broke the camel's back in this economy with the livestock industry, and it's really not true. On the average, since we've been keeping records mid-1980s, perhaps 60 to 70 cattle, most of them are calves and yearling cattle, are lost each year in the Northern Rockies region to wolves. And an average of about 130 sheep. And I just remind people, do the arithmetic that there's about 850,000 ewes that go out onto the range in Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana. And there's about 5.5 million range cattle. So it's a very small percentage, but nonetheless, we've always treated it as a significant loss to the individual producer when we document that wolves killed some livestock.
Of course, ranchers have some power politically, right? And so there's been some rules written in that you can retaliate yet, right? You can try to protect your livestock.
Yeah, agriculture is pretty much number one in many of the states in the Rocky Mountain region. And ever since the reintroduction, whether it was federal agent that did the removal or gradually as their numbers grew, a livestock producer was allowed to, you know, kill wolves in the act of, we've always been responsive to livestock loss, and wolves that become a problem have been eliminated.
Hmm. I'm sure you took many complaints from ranchers. Probably still get confronted by ranchers.
Yeah, it was the nature of my job. I was pretty much on call 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and spent most of my career working with ranchers, and I've had a very good working relationship with them. My job was to just go out as a detective and determine, is there a problem or isn't there one, and what is the problem? Did a predator cause the death of livestock, or was it a lightning strike or disease or calving problem?
Mm-hmm. We'll get into that a little later. We're going to take a break here coming up pretty soon, and we'll talk about this. When the wolf was reintroduced, some of these conflicts started happening, complaints, political heat was increased, in fact, at the boiling point. And Carter Niemeyer decided to take a look at some of this from a scientific point of view. We'll talk about where that took him. But just before we take this break, from your point of view, what's the future in the next 5 or 10 years? What's wolf population likely to get up to and likely to spread in significant numbers to other states?
Yeah, this is just a comment, not a threat, but wolves are here to stay. We have about 1,700 in the northern Rocky Mountain region. That population will grow some, but I don't think a whole lot more. But absolutely, we can expect that there's going to be dispersal into surrounding states.
We'll talk about the 1980s into the 90s. Carter Niemeyer at first was assigned a trap to kill wolves as they started reappearing in the western United States. Then, of course, with the decision in the 1990s to reintroduce wolves officially, Carter Niemeyer was assigned to help in that plan. And through some of that scientific study, Carter Niemeyer had a change of heart, you might call it. He calls it becoming educated and became an advocate for wolves. It made things a little uncomfortable at the agency he worked with, and it puts him right in the middle. There's skepticism from all sides, but he's uniquely positioned in this whole debate. We'll also talk about his observations of wolf behavior and some of the individual wolves that he's known. All of that to come following a break. We're talking with Carter Niemeyer. He's written a memoir. It's called Wolfer. And he'll talk about his experiences. What's the real story regarding livestock and wolves?
The Memoir Series, a selection of memoirs by summer citizens and students participating in the 4-Minute Memoirs course at Utah State University.
Coming back home. Growing up mid-century as we did, we lived in a room in our family home in high school or in a dorm room at college. We probably had a roommate, a brother or sister at home, or a friend at college. Life was simple. Studies, friends, new experiences, a good life being anticipated. We probably thought of home as the place our parents lived and where we had grown up. But it was a place we had a feeling for. Happy or not, it was home. Then at some point, we began to view it as an investment. But who lives in an investment? We couldn't wait to move out of our first apartment and get some appreciable property. The bigger, the better. Remember all those 70s homes built of tissue paper? 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and a family room. Thousands of them. We were into quantity. Quality is what was left behind, the sacrifice we didn't yet understand. Maybe we found a bigger place, or a small plot of land in the country, some acreage maybe. Then some rental property. Trade up. Use the equity gain to buy more. Inflation, appreciation, tax advantages. Getting a leg up. The American dream. So who lives in an investment? Did we forget something? Where we live and how is too important to subordinate to financial gain. When did having more square feet begin to be mean more happiness? Two bathrooms are great, but someone has to clean them. Three baths, more cleaning. Are we nuts? And all that grass, acres upon acres of grass. Someone could play a round of golf through our neighborhoods, and we would barely notice. Now we have the McMansions, ever bigger and fancier. If this is too much, buy a condo. Have a pool without the pool guy. Buy on a golf course. Then they don't have to play golf through your neighborhood anymore. Then as a bonus, more grass. Maybe ownership is overrated. Ask the people who are upside down on their mortgages. The American dream underwater. In Arizona, where the ground is flat and the sun always shines, there are roads that stretch out into the desert, miles in all directions. Every few miles, there's a new mall or office complex. Many are empty, and the ones with tenants are far from full. Ask yourself, why do we need so many Home Depots? Simple. It's to service all these cheap-built homes, offices, and stores, and all that grass. Where did all these investment properties go? Well, they're still there, except now they're 20, 30, or even more years old. Banks own a good share of them. Do you remember when you could go out and have a selection of nice homes to choose from? Now there are few homes actually for sale. Most of the many empty houses we see around are in foreclosure. That'll keep them empty for a while. Many are short sales. This is a long process in which the bank has an agreement with the owner to buy down the mortgage if they agree to sell them. This may take months or even years. It is a wearing down process. If you want a decent home in a good neighborhood and be able to move in anytime soon, be prepared to bid for it. They are in short supply. There are plenty of worn-out junk, though, where the grass outside is dry and shaggy and the carpet inside is damp and shag. Some say you can never go back home. I think when we find a room in a house where we are loved and we start thinking of it as our home, then finally we will be back home again. This is Brian Gage, UPR Radio.
This has been a memoir from the Memoir Series, a selection of memoirs by summer citizens and students participating in the 4-Minute Memoirs course at Utah State University. This program of Access Utah aired originally earlier this year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are talking this hour with Carter Niemeyer. He's a wolf expert, and in fact, his life has turned out to be right in the middle of the wolf controversy. He's been on all sides of this. He started out working for an obscure federal agency, which trapped and relocated, in some cases killed predators. The Animal Damage Control Agency turned into?
They changed their name to Wildlife Services.
Wildlife Services. And in the middle of all this was assigned to work with the wolf reintroduction in the 1990s, has become an advocate for wolves. And Carter Niemeyer has written a memoir. It's called Wolfer. So you have in your time hunted, killed wolves?
Yeah, in my career, I actually kept count. I've killed 14 wolves on the job, you know, mostly related to livestock damage.
Mm-hmm. And you've trapped many other wolves.
I've personally captured over 300 wolves. Mm-hmm. A lot through foothold trapping and then also helicopter darting.
What's that like, hunting a predator like that?
Well, that's what makes me tick ever since I was a little kid. That's why I loved hunting and trapping, is pursuit and capture of the target animal. And the wolf thing really honed my skills because you are specifically looking for an individual wolf or pack. So absolutely, it's got my metabolism up when I do that.
Predators, I would imagine, aren't used to being hunted.
Well, no, usually they are the hunters, and they're at the top of the pyramid, you might say. So, it's a challenge. They're smart, they're wary, and you have to understand their behavior.
Let's go to our first caller, who is Zachariah from Moab. Zachariah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
I just wanted to ask Carter what some of the misconceptions were that he has come up against with people on both sides of the argument, either from the ranching community or animal or environmental advocates.
Well, I think that's one of the biggest problems. When you say misconceptions, there's a tremendous number of misconceptions about wolves, including, are the wolves that are here now the same ones that were here in the past? For all practical purposes, yes, they are. They're Canis lupus. They're the gray wolf. There's a misconception that somehow the wolves we brought from Canada are diseased. I would dispute that, too. There's those who say, wolves are here first, let them alone. By the same token, wolves have to definitely fit into the human society. So looking at it from the other angle, if wolves become a problem, we need to resolve that problem, whether it's removal of the animal or whatever it takes. There's lethal and non-lethal ways to accomplish that. So it's best for the wolf if we allow them a place to fit in, and where they don't fit in, we're going to have to take corrective measures.
Zachariah, does that answer your question?
That does. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Carter Niemeyer as well. He's author of a memoir called Wolfer. He started out in predator control. He's hunted and killed some wolves, relocated many others, and in 1990s was put in charge of relocation of wolves. Of course, we all remember that from the mid-1990s, and he's then was point man to explain all this to the ranchers and the public. He's kind of been in the uncomfortable middle on this issue for most of his career. Sort of expanding on Zachariah's question, I wonder what you would, what you do say to try to help people on either side of this issue understand it. Say to a conservationist, a person who maybe, in the view of the other side, over-idealizes the wolf, what would you tell them?
Well, I try to tell everybody, let's be reasonable. Mm-hmm. That's the first step. There's places that wolves are not going to fit in. It's bad for the wolf. I always tell people, look at the big picture. If you have a particular wolf or a pack of wolves that become a problem, and it's documented, they're killing livestock, for instance, it's better to just take those out and move on. And there will be other wolves come along, probably take up housekeeping in the same neighborhood. But what you don't want is a bunch of unresolved problems, documented, confirmed problems with wolves that go unresolved, because then that just leads to polarization. People get upset, and it becomes political, and it has become political. So I just tell people we got to be reasonable, and there is a place for wolves, and they can fit in, but we've just got to look at each situation.
What about the other side? You're talking to a rancher who perhaps thinks the federal government is just stomping on his or her property rights, bringing in this unwanted predator that's going to cause damage to his or her property.
Well, I can understand. If you're a livestock producer and we turn a bunch of big dogs loose in your backyard, you're not going to be happy with it. But as a nation, and first of all, remind people this was a congressional mandate. It wasn't Carter Niemeyer and a few biologists dreamed up this idea. We're simply the messengers were simply the personnel who were given that task to reintroduce wolves. But certainly if you raise livestock, it's another predator in your backyard. And again, I remind people, wolves are here to stay. A congressional act put them here. Only a congressional act will probably ever remove them. So I think everyone has to make up their mind that wolves potentially can be in your backyard. So you need to be more vigilant, more aware, and communicative with people that if you do have wolves that do show up, there are ways to manage them if they come in conflict.
Hunters sometimes have a problem with wolves. Perhaps they see a wolf as a competition for the game that they want to take.
Absolutely. That's become a big issue up in Idaho especially. And I'm a hunter. I don't want anybody to ever get the idea that I'm not a big game hunter. I have been ever since I moved out west. But again, as a hunter, I'm not concerned about wolves eating an elk or two or three or, you know, in an average a wolf in a year can probably eat the equivalent of probably 16 elk-sized animals, if that's all that it ate. But I can't get concerned from my vantage point as a sportsman that wolves are going to outcompete me for an elk. If I want to go out and hunt, I will get an elk, and anyone else can too.
One of the complaints that I've read that you hear that goes against the wolf in the minds of some people is the way they kill.
Yeah, well, first thing I always tell people is look in the mirror. Look how we kill. Bullets aren't clean, neither are arrows. So we're all predators, humans, wolves, coyotes, whatever. Yes, wolves do have to kill large prey to feed themselves. It probably isn't a pretty scene to some. But again, this is a human emotional issue. We're imposing ourselves on a way that predator and prey have functioned for tens of thousands of years. Hmm. And so I don't get analytical about whatever word you want to describe how a wolf kills prey. That's what wolves do.
Hmm. I don't know what your opinion was on the reintroduction. Of course, it's your job, and especially in 1995, you're put in charge of going up and getting those first wolves. But before that, did you have an opinion?
I had no opinion whatsoever. I had never even thought really about wolves in that regard of reintroducing them. Activity, this plan, this movement all started. And as I point out in my book, I'm a hunter, I'm a trapper. I think working with wolves was cool, and all I knew is I wanted to be a part of it. Hmm. But I didn't have an agenda, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea.
I don't know whether you heard from people who maybe had a problem with you being put in charge of part of this, you know, saying, oh, Carter, he's a hunter, he's a trapper. Now he's going to go up and be part of the reintroduction.
Yeah, it put me in a compromising position with folks. On the one hand, early in my career, I would say predator advocates were on my case all the time and very critical of my job. And then later, as my job evolved into becoming a wolf manager, which meant kind of policing the whole thing, then I started catching it from the other direction, you know, from livestock producers who thought that I should be less sympathetic toward the wolf. And all I tried to do was just balance my judgment calls and try to look at the facts and then manage wolves on a case-by-case basis.
Now, at some point, I don't know whether this was before or after the official reintroduction, I think you started to want to take a look from a scientific point of view. After all, you're a trained biologist of the livestock damage, right? And what the wolves had left behind. Let's take the emotion out of this. Let's look at the scientific evidence.
Well, I found out quickly that I had to, because I was under the microscope from all sides, and there was a lot of assumptions being made by a lot of folks. A lot of agency people assuming, well, if there's wolves near a cow pasture, there's going to be dead cows. And so a lot of ranchers looked at it the same viewpoint. We can't have wolves in our backyard, or we're going to have dead sheep and dead cattle. Well, there's always dead sheep and dead cattle and dead horses on the range from a multitude of causes. And where I got caught up in this whole situation was I was kind of the judge and jury. I had to go out and look at all this dead livestock and determine, you know, are wolves connected to this? And I found early on, and to some degree yet, that wolves are implicated in an awful lot of situations that they're really not involved in at all.
Hmm. Did that change your views?
Well, it made me more determined to stand my ground, be fair, be impartial, and be honest.
Hmm.
There's a lot of pressure on a guy to go out there and come back with a certain answer. And if your answer doesn't fit the political agenda at the time, you get crossways with an awful lot of people. And I figure if I stay honest, that's the safest ground to be on.
Hmm. But imagine as you came back with reports, you know, maybe more in favor of the conservationists, that made things uncomfortable with you in the other community.
Well, yeah, I've been accused of being a turncoat and disloyal, a plant, a government hack. I've heard all the criticisms that you can possibly can be thrown your way. Again, I just look at the facts. I look at the investigations. It's like police. You know, a policeman doesn't convict somebody. A policeman collects evidence and lets the jury decide is the person guilty. And that's pretty much what I do with the wolf situation.
So maybe in an aggregate, all of the investigations you've done, can you draw a conclusion? Do you think that complaints of ranchers generally are overblown?
Some ranchers, they are overblown, obviously, and there's other ranchers I've found who absolutely want the truth. And they have accepted the answer and said, this is all I want to know. I just want you to tell me, were wolves involved? Or you can talk about bears, lions, coyotes, whatever. But there's agendas always out there that if you don't want to, you don't want the wolf around, they can get a lot of bad press.
Mm. It's been, I don't know, more than 10 years now since the official reintroduction of the wolf. Wolf populations are growing, spreading. That's the design. But this is still very, very heated, very controversial. Is there a solution that you see to having all sides come together?
I keep that's really my goal, is to try to get people to sit down and talk about this and be reasonable. No, I think it's about as polarized right now as I've ever seen it. During the days after the reintroduction, there were people unhappy, but now I see, you know, the livestock industry wants some real sideboards put on this thing. Sportsmen have really gotten vocal now, and they're real concerned about the future of hunting and the future of deer and elk herds. Again, with the number of wolves we're talking about, 1,700 of them in the northern Rockies, and now we in Montana and Idaho, we have hunting and trapping season in Idaho, hunting season in Montana. These wolves are manageable, and we can live with some of these wolves. They're not going to decimate these prey herds like deer and elk.
I was reading in excess of, what, some 1,600 wolves at this point?
That's what we estimate the minimum population would be, 1,700 wolves.
What's the plan? What's the design in terms of numbers into the future?
Well, if you look at state management, you know, they were delisted in April of 2011, and the states are managing them now in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana specifically. The states want to take those numbers down. Idaho, for instance, we estimate we have 750 wolves. The Fish and Game Commission in Idaho has said we'd like to manage them down to the bare bones minimum of 152 wolves.
Mm.
If they go below 150, you're looking at relisting them, which the states don't want to go there. So they're going to have to manage them at some level higher than that. But the plan, I think all three of those states plan to take wolf numbers down significantly from where they are now.
Will management, do you think, include sanctioned wolf hunts?
Sanctioned wolf hunts are occurring in Idaho and Montana now. Mm. Wyoming hasn't got them delisted, but there's a possibility they could be delisted by their fall hunting season. So, yes, hunting is one of the options already on the table.
Just have a couple minutes left. I'm curious about that seminal event. You were involved in bringing the Adam and Eve, you might call it, the first, those first wolves into the U.S. First official wolves, I guess you could say. What was that like?
Well, I'm accused of bringing the wolves here. I can safely say I didn't bring the wolves to the Northern Rockies reintroduction sites in Idaho and Wyoming. I was on the capture team. I was in the helicopters that caught the wolves. We caught them. We put them in holding facilities in Canada, and then we put them in individual shipping crates on a cargo plane and shipped them down to another team of biologists who received them. But yeah, it was history making. I don't think anything has ever been done quite like it. And with all the polarization, it may never be done again.
So what was the feeling, that general feeling on that team? This was history in the making.
Yeah, I can't put it in words. It was a joint effort by the Canadian and American team, and I've never seen a more dedicated group of biologists, trappers, working together to get the job done. It was first rate, and nobody got killed. The wolves showed up in grade A condition. We were very successful in a very short period of time.
And thereafter, I suppose everyone's very curious, concerned. Will these wolves make it? Will they spread as designed?
Yeah, I don't think any of us knew for sure how this was going to go. There was a lot of analysis went into through the environmental impact statement process. And a lot of those predictions were pretty accurate, actually. But the wolves bred in captivity, actually, so they took off right from the start.
Right from the start, no problems.
Yeah, we caught them in January, and so their breeding season begins in mid-February. So the wolves were confined in Yellowstone in one-acre facilities. And it's obvious they bred in captivity because there were some litters of pups from in 1995 from that very first group of wolves we caught in Alberta.
And finally, just 30 seconds left, what would you say in conclusion about the wolf? For example, here in Utah, there are some sightings, they say. I imagine wolves would come here.
Well, there's no doubt that we know from radio collaring wolves and looking at their dispersal movements that they can travel hundreds of miles. So if you take a compass reading off of Yellowstone National Park in central Idaho and draw a 400 or 500 mile radius, if Utah fits into there, you can expect wolves.
Very good. The book is Wolfer. It's a memoir. Carter Niemeyer is the author. Carter Niemeyer, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening today to Access Utah.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
The road trip to Yellowstone with the kids and grandkids came and went, blissfully calm and uneventful, if you don't count a staggering number of bison and calves, elk with large racks, distant grizzly bears, and a wolf sighting or two. It was great. This trip, however, I did something I've never done before. In fact, I've adamantly and purposely not done it before. I took the tram from Teton Village and rode up to the top of Rendezvous Mountain. That might not be considered daring to most of you, but for me, it was an act of courage that should be profiled. I have a long, though distant, relationship with trams. My first experience with one in high school when my Latin class fielded a team at the National High School Latin Conference in New Mexico. Yep, first thing out of the bag, we were all clambering aboard the tramway that travels to dizzying heights above the city of Albuquerque and comes to the rest at the top of Sandia Mountain. I was petrified the entire trip up and down, and if I recall correctly, saw very little of the panoramas that my classmates were oohing and aahing over. I vowed then I would never, ever get on another tram, period. Years passed. Married, I moved to France for 6 months with husband and three kids. As near as I can make out, there is not one single place in France, or in Europe for that matter, that doesn't have a tram. As it happened, we lived in Grenoble, in the heart of the French Alps. Bien sûr. Grenoble proudly sports a téléphérique, the fancy French name for a tram. Its little glass-bubbled cars dangle hideously over the Isère River, which bisects the city, and carries its poor, unsuspecting passengers high up to a point on the nearby mountain called the Bastille. My husband and children had a wonderful trip up to the old fort. Me, I stayed nicely grounded and shopped in the stores along the river. Living in the Alps meant, naturally, a visit to Chamonix and Mont Blanc. I hear the trip up and down the tram is breathtaking, or rather, I see it in pictures taken of my kids and husband on top of the Aiguille du Midi, looking for all the world like Sir Edmund Hillary and his pals up on top of Everest. Me? I decided it was time to go to Italy via the Mont Blanc tunnel. I thus spent 7 stifling, exhaust-laden miles traveling behind burping lorries and belching Renaults to reach Courmayeur in Italy. I spent the same 7 miles returning through the tunnel to Chamonix, where, biliously pale and wheezy, I congratulated my hearty band of mountaineers on their intrepid adventure. Another excursion during the same 6 months brought us to Salzburg. Home of Mozart, the city is also home to a particularly grim tram, the world's oldest. It was already up and running in the 1400s when it was operated by 4 poor horses. It begins in the town and rises evilly up to the famed Salzburg Castle. Me? Again, I really don't know what the ride up and down was like because I actually walked up to the fortress. Oh, it was hot and long, but by golly, a gal needs her exercise. And then there was the Capri Funicular. Yes, that Capri, Blue Grotto, etc., etc. Because it's low to the ground, a kind of trolley car rather than a dangling death trap, I agreed to ride it to the top. I had to close my eyes most of the way up, however, because it literally went straight up. The ride ended in the Gardens of Augustus, which, if your heart was still beating, you might have enjoyed. The gardens in turn overlooked the azure blue of the Mediterranean, and the view, I was told, was breathtakingly lovely. I had to be nearly blindfolded for the ride down. So you see, riding the Teton Village tram was an act of sheer bravery on my part, though it has forced me to once again reinstate my vow. I will never ride a tram or a teleferique or a funicular ever again. And I mean it this time. This is Gina Wickwater.